Lecture 12, Lewis and Clark, the Explorers.
In an earlier lecture, we saw how President Jefferson bent the constitutional rules when he seized the opportunity of buying the Louisiana Territory from France. Lewis and Clark, a pair of army captains, led the Corps of Discovery on a 3-year mission. Their job was to map the territory to see whether it would provide an easy route to the West Coast and the Pacific Ocean for trade with Asia, and to gain American control of the lucrative Trans-Mississippi fur trade. These two captains, Lewis and Clark, worked very well together, lost only one of their 33 men, despite Indian attacks, sicknesses, and bouts of near starvation. And they brought back to President Jefferson a vast trove of information about the American West, its geography, its flora, its fauna, and its peoples. Their industriousness as observers and collectors, and their self-discipline in the face of human and natural threats, assured the expedition's success. And it's surely they who laid the foundations of the nation's subsequent westward expansion. The two men's early experiences prepared them for this demanding expedition. Lewis, Meriwether Lewis, was an army officer. He was President Jefferson's near neighbor in Virginia, and he'd become the president's private secretary. He was living at or near the White House for most of the years between 1801 and 1803, and constantly learning from the president. He also spent time in Philadelphia studying science and medicine and navigation. He was gathering up a great range of skills which would be useful on the expedition and learning and getting insight into the president's own frame of mind. He was moody, a loner. Often during their voyage up the Missouri River, he'd go out alone on shore, reconnoiter on his own. By contrast, Clark, also a Virginian, was much more gregarious. He'd been an army officer too, and in fact he'd been Lewis's commander during their active service during the Whiskey Rebellion. His older brother, George Rogers Clark, was a Revolutionary War hero in the old Northwest country. He was a friendly man, very, very good at what we'd call human relations, and an excellent map maker. Both men on the expedition kept detailed diaries and notes. They knew that it would be very easy for their papers to get lost, for the boats to capsize, and so they duplicated all their records. Although, in fact, most of what each of them wrote survived. So we've got extremely detailed accounts of what happened literally from day to day on the Lewis and Clark expedition. I know I've said this several times during the course already. We benefit from the fact that Americans from an early stage were highly literate, and we can learn a lot of the details of what they did and thought and said. Now, their expedition into the Louisiana Territory followed the major waterways across the American West. Do you remember that when I talked about John Smith, I was describing the way in which the Virginia Company, way back in 1607, had hoped to find a simple route to the Pacific. They hadn't known how far across the North American continent was, and had speculated that it might just be just a few miles. So they'd had John Smith looking for it. By Jefferson's time, it was understood that the continent was very, very broad, but the idea of a good river route across America and from there on to Asia remained a deeply attractive possibility. At this point, it still wasn't clear that the United States of America was ever going to span the entire continent. The Louisiana Purchase was from the mouth of the Mississippi, everything west of that river, up as far as the crest of the Rocky Mountains. That still left a much greater area further to the west, which was not yet claimed by the United States. Jefferson knew that a Scotsman called Alexander Mackenzie had crossed Canada from east to west in 1793 and had published a book about it in 1801. In fact, Lewis and Clark carried a copy of this book with them on their own expedition. Well, Lewis began by crossing over the Appalachian Mountains from Washington and then sailing down the Ohio River from Pittsburgh to its junction with the Mississippi. If you look at maps from this time, from the Revolution and the early 19th century, the rivers are the dominant features on them because those were the principal routeways. In the middle of the 19th century, look at a map and you'll find that the railways are the dominant feature because that had become the standard form of transport. And of course, in our own day, the Rand McNally Atlas and so on has the roads as the principal routeway. How you travel is the thing which tends to get emphasized on the maps. And in those days, it was the rivers. So he sails all the way down the Ohio River, past Cincinnati and past Louisville to the Mississippi itself. When the expedition got going from St. Louis, Lewis was 29 and Clark was 33. Lewis nominally had the senior rank, but the two of them acted as equals throughout and never told the men about these rank differences. They called one another captain and were able to collaborate very effectively in leadership of the group. From St. Louis in the spring of 1804, the expedition set off westwards along the Missouri River, across what's now the middle of the state of Missouri, and then eventually when it turns northwards, up into what's now North Dakota. Now, the Missouri River was a very, very difficult river to sail up. Often extremely shallow, extremely winding, so the meanders took up hundreds of extra miles, full of unpredictable and constantly shifting sandbars, all of which had changed by the time they came back a couple of years later. It was very, very grueling and difficult progress with a keel boat and their canoes. Sometimes the boats had to be dragged by shorelines, or the men actually had to stand in the water and pull, or they had to pole it along on the edge of the current. The boat was heavy because it was laden with trade goods, which they were going to use in their encounters with the Indians as they proceeded up the river. Along the way, they found all sorts of new and interesting things, new creatures like prairie dogs and breeds of deer and antelope that they hadn't previously known about, and very, very good descriptions they wrote of the landscape. There were 33 men on the expedition. One of them, York, was Clark's slave. Lewis had asked Clark to recruit men who were, quote, good hunters, stout, healthy unmarried young men, accustomed to the woods and capable of bearing bodily fatigue to a pretty considerable extent. And they had with them a Newfoundland dog. Well, this group was big enough that if it came to an encounter with an Indian war party, they could fight back effectively, but not too big that it would be very difficult to feed. Lewis and Clark early on established firm army discipline by court-martialing delinquents. In the early days, for example, two men were found to have stolen whiskey from the supplies when they were on guard. Another one was found to have fallen asleep while he was supposed to be on guard duty. And another one, again, had made mutinous talk against the expedition as a whole. All of them were flogged. In other words, the officers are establishing the principle that they won't accept insubordination. But as the journey continues, as we read more deeply into their journals, we find less and less problems with insubordination. What appears to have happened is that the men really did develop a very, very implicit trust in them, so that the men gave their full support to the expedition. Obviously also vital when you're penetrating deep into previously unknown country. As they moved up the river, they made treaties with the Indians they met. And they spent the winter of 1804-5 with one of these Indian groups, the Mandans. Now, all the Indians they met, they found that they were very eager to steal from them if possible. And that's because the stuff they were bringing with them on their boat represented an incredible source of wealth to the Indians. This is a period when any Indian group which had got guns had an enormous advantage in its conflict with the other Indian groups which didn't have guns. So they're desperate to get their hands on them if they possibly could. They could use them, they could fire them, but what they couldn't do was make them or repair them. So having guns would itself make them dependent. In other words, it was a Faustian bargain, you could put it that way. It makes them dependent, but it gives them temporary superiority. Also, they loved the whiskey which Lewis and Clark were carrying with them in large quantities, and of which they were sometimes given a little taste. Sometimes, the threat of theft led Lewis and Clark to fire warning volleys at Indians as they clamoured around the group. And early on, they understood they had to exercise perpetual vigilance to avoid being overrun and stolen from. They were very good ethnographers, what we'd call good early anthropologists. They recognised that the tribes had their own way of thinking about the world. For example, in October of 1804, Clark writes this. Several Indians came to see us this evening, amongst others the son of the late great chief of the Mandans, mourning for his father. This man has had his two little fingers cut off. On inquiring the cause, we were told it was customary for this nation to show their grief by some testimony of pain, and that it was not uncommon for them to take off two smaller fingers of the hand. There was self-amputations. A little bit later in the 1830s, the artist George Catlin would also spend some time living with the Mandans, and he witnessed one of these rituals, where a coming-of-age ritual where the young men would also sacrifice a finger to the hunting gods that was paying for the pain they endured with greater hunting medicine. They had to stop in November 1804 because the river froze up and it was too cold to carry on. So they built a palisade near a little fortress nearby the Mandan village. And while they were there, during that winter, they witnessed a whole array of fascinating rituals that the Mandans practiced. One of them was a sexual ritual, and it went like this. The young braves, the young warriors, would bring their wives into a meeting house and try to persuade the old men there to have sex with their wives. And they'd beg them, please, please take them away. And at first, Lewis and Clark are very surprised by this because it seems odd. But gradually they realise that what's happening is this. It was difficult to get old in the Mandan tribe because nearly all the men were killed either in hunting or in fighting. They're warrior societies. Most of the men didn't make it to the age of 30. So if you did become old, that was a sign that you got great spiritual power, that the gods had sympathized with you. And so the young men want to find a way of getting hold of some of that spiritual power, some of that medicine. And so they use their wives as instruments of transmission. In other words, the idea is the old man would confer this power on the wife, and she'd then pass it on through sex to the young man. Now, because Lewis and Clark have come upriver in this amazing boat with all this incredible stuff they've got with them, the Indians early on thought, here are people with a lot of spiritual power. So Lewis and Clark's men were delighted to find that they were also popular as sexual partners for the Mandan women, and that the braves would bring them their wives as well. But of course, sex is always an explosive subject, isn't it? And later on, when they were with the Shoshone Indians the following summer, Lewis and Clark said to their men, you've got to be very careful not to have sex with the women without their husband's consent, because this can be a source of very, very serious trouble. But Lewis also writes in his notebook a sort of wry comment. He says, to prevent this mutual exchange of good offices altogether, I know it is impossible to effect, particularly on the part of our young men, whom some months' abstinence have made very polite to these tawny damsels. A lovely circumspect way, I think, of saying that. Very polite. Well, now, among the recruits who joined them that first winter were Charbonneau, a French trapper, and his Indian wife, Sacajawea, with their newborn son, Jean-Baptiste. She was just a teenager, 14 or 15. In other words, French fur trappers had already got this far upstream, up the Missouri River. But beyond this, the land and the course of the river were almost completely unknown. In that spring of 1805, they sent the big keel boat back to St. Louis and headed on upstream in canoes and pirogues. And with a great sense of the momentousness of the occasion, here's Lewis writing on April the 7th, 1805. This little fleet, although not quite so respectable as those of Columbus or Captain Cook, were still viewed by us with as much pleasure as those deservedly famous adventurers ever beheld theirs. And I dare say, with quite as much anxiety for their safety and preservation. We are now about to penetrate a country at least 2,000 miles in width, on which the foot of civilized man has never yet trodden. Entertaining as I do the most confident hope of succeeding in a voyage which has formed a darling project of mine for the last 10 years, I could but esteem this moment of my departure as among the most happy of my life. The party are in excellent health and spirits, zealously attached to the enterprise, and anxious to proceed. Well, once again, progress was impeded early in 1805 by human and natural obstacles. They had some very narrow escapes from bear attacks. On one occasion, 6 men, all of them experienced hunters, shot a massive bear and hit it, but it kept on coming towards them, and 2 of them had to throw themselves off a 20-foot cliff and into the river to save their lives. A little bit later on, Lewis was out hunting alone, and he shot a buffalo, and then very incautiously went towards it before reloading his gun, even though he knew that that was something he ought not to do. Suddenly he discovered a bear, which he hadn't previously noticed, was coming towards him, and his gun wasn't charged. He also had to rush into the river. And finally, the bear came in after him, so he turned around to face it, brandishing his espontoon, the kind of the rest on which he'd place a musket, and was getting ready to beat the bear in the head when, to his great relief, the bear turned around and ambled off. So, lots of dangers in this way. Now, no Americans then had seen the Rocky Mountains. They knew there was a mountain range. They knew that rivers always flow out of hills or mountains of some kind. They didn't know how big the hills were. Their hope was that they'd be a low rise, if anything a little bit less than the Appalachians, and that it would be an easy matter to sail all the way up to the headwaters of the Missouri, hop over the ridge and jump back into the boat and go down the other side to the Pacific. But of course, if you've seen the Rocky Mountains, you know it's not like that. They're snow-covered peaks and they're much more magnificent than the Appalachians. So their first sighting of the Rockies was both impressive but also profoundly disappointing to them. It became clear at once that they weren't going to be able to make a simple crossing. Here's what Clark wrote. I felt a secret pleasure in finding myself so near the head of the heretofore conceived boundless Missouri River. But when I reflected on the difficulties which this snowy barrier would most probably throw in my way to the Pacific, and the sufferings and hardships of myself and the party in them, it in some measure counterbalanced the joy I felt in the first moments which I gazed on them. Another problem they encountered was the Great Falls of the Missouri, because, of course, it's impossible to sail the boats up the falls. And eventually, the Great Falls compelled them to abandon their boats altogether and proceed on foot. If there had just been one waterfall, it might have been possible to unload the boats, carry them up above the fall, and then reload them and carry on. But in fact, there's a whole succession of them, 20 or 30 of these cataracts and waterfalls, spread over a distance of 20 miles. And the labor involved in carrying everything that far was simply too much for them. They brought with them a lightweight frame boat called the Experiment, and the hope was that they could carry this as far as necessary and then put it into the water and sail also. But in fact, it proved to be impractical. They couldn't make it watertight. The bark of the trees out where they were was different from that of the eastern forests, which could be used as a sealant. And when they tried stitching it together or stitching animal skins from those they'd hunted, the skins shrank and the boat sank. So suddenly they're high up the Missouri River without a viable means of continuing. That meant it was imperative that they needed to get hold of horses if they were going to go any further. And that in turn meant that they had to contact some of the Indians who had horses. Also, as they proceeded further up the Missouri River and it got smaller, they quite often came to junctions and it wasn't clear which way they should go. Of course, what they wanted to do was to follow the river as deeply into the mountains as they possibly could. So which was the main channel? Sometimes they'd send an expedition up both channels in the hope of finding out. But they also realized another possibility was this. If they tested the temperature in each of two channels, it would be a good idea to take the warmer of the two, because that suggested it had flowed further since it melted from being snow and ice. You see that? A logical little resolution to a dilemma. And this way they keep moving further up the river. Well, finally, it was the fact that they did meet and make friends with the Shoshone Indians which kept the expedition alive at one of its crucial moments. And they were particularly fortunate in that Sacagawea was herself a Shoshone who'd been sold as a slave down the river earlier in her life. She spoke the language, which otherwise would also have presented a severe barrier. The Indians were extremely suspicious of them at first, fearing an ambush by some of their warlike neighbours, but eventually contact and cooperation was assured. Now, this band of the Shoshones was itself very, very near to starvation. And when one of the French trappers called Druillard, who was travelling with Lewis and Clark, when he shot and killed a deer, Lewis describes what happens in response to this deer being brought down. Quote, "The Indians dismounted and ran in, tumbling over each other like a parcel of famished dogs, each seizing and tearing away a part of the intestines, which had previously been thrown out by Druillard, who killed it. The scene was such, when I arrived, that had I not had a pretty keen appetite myself, I'm confident I should not have tasted any part of that venison. Each one of them had a piece of some description, and all eating most ravenously. Some were eating the kidneys, the melt and liver, and the blood was running from the corners of their mouths. Others were in a similar situation with the paunch and guts of this deer, but the exuding substance in this case from their lips was of a different description. In other words, they're literally tearing apart this deer within seconds of it being killed and eating everything, including its uncleaned intestines." Well, mutual suspicions between the two groups began to thaw slightly when it turned out that the leader of this band, Kamawayet, was actually the brother of Sacagawea, who'd been taken prisoner years earlier and was now joyously reunited with her brother. With the help of the Shoshones, who drove a very hard bargain with them about the horse trade, they were able to cross over the crest of the Rocky Mountains and get into the headwaters of the Snake River, which they followed down to its junction with the Columbia River, and so eventually all the way down to the Pacific coast. But in the Rockies there, they had long starving times, very, very little access to food, and were forced to kill and eat some of their own horses in order to be able to survive. And suffered intense cold in the early fall as well because of the high altitude. When they got to the Columbia River, they decided to build rafts to accelerate their progress. Rather than going down by horseback, they'd raft down the river. Although the Indians they met there, the Nez Perce Indians, told them, "You will certainly drown and die if you attempt it." Nevertheless, they did. And finally, in November of 1805, they arrived at the coast, at the mouth of the Columbia River on the Pacific coast. This is today the place where, which marks the Oregon-Washington state boundary. And Clark writes, "Great joy in camp. We are within view of the ocean, this great Pacific Ocean, which we have been for so long so anxious to see." And they spent that winter right there, at the in the mouth of the Columbia River, again, cohabiting uneasily with the local Indians and building a fortress to protect themselves and the stuff they had with them. And they tried to make sure that all the Indians were out by sundown, because by then they'd become familiar with the fact that the Indians would steal everything they could possibly get their hands on, if possible. The Indians were very eager to trade with them, and they'd trade their wives' sexuality for goods, which again is something that Lewis and Clark's men very much wanted. They found that the Indians were extremely eager to get their hands on blue beads. I mentioned earlier that John Smith had also found blue beads a very, very attractive trade commodity. And the winter was a very tense one because of deteriorating relations and constant frictions with the Indians, whom they looked upon as predatory. There was evidence that British and American whaling fleets had previously touched in at the mouth of the Columbia River. Obviously, the Pacific Ocean had already been fairly well explored by European navigators. Captain Cook had been there, and by now the whaling fleets used to come in there. Apart from anything else, they discovered a sailor's name tattooed on the arm of one of the Indian women. Obviously, that's fairly vivid evidence. And the fact that most of the women and many of the men were suffering from venereal disease was another one. This was clearly an illness which had been introduced by American and European sailors. If you've spent the winter there, you know that it's an extremely wet part of the world. All the clothes they got, mainly made of deerskin and leather, were rotting off their backs. Everything was infested with lice, which was perhaps almost inevitable in those days when you were living outside for a long period of time. Nearly everybody was sick. Everyone was suffering from the early stages of malnutrition. It was a winter of great ordeal, much less cold than the previous one had been, but nevertheless difficult. They fired their guns in volleys overhead to celebrate Christmas Day and to celebrate New Year's Day of 1806, and had a bright moment when they discovered the body of a dead whale washed up on the beach, because from it they could get a lot of food and oil and supplies from it. Their journey back was also punctuated by great adventures. What they wanted to do was to set off coinciding with the salmon run up the Columbia River, because then the salmon would provide them with a good source of food. But they knew that if they waited too long, they'd get stuck perhaps somewhere in the high plains by the following winter, and they were hoping to make it all the way back within that year, 1806. So they decided they must set off early. They'd also hoped that they might encounter a ship there in the estuary of the Columbia River. And in fact, later on, they found that a ship had been there. An American brig called the Lydia had come in from Boston. But for reasons we're not quite sure of, they'd never been within sight of it. And so they'd missed their opportunity of getting a ride home that way. So the result was that early in the spring of 1806, they set off, resolved to go all the way back again on foot or horseback if possible. As they approached the Rocky Mountains, they actually split up so that each of them could explore different sets of the river valleys there in the Rockies. And Clark traced the course of the Yellowstone River. Lewis had a more adventurous time, coming into conflict directly with some of the Blackfoot Indians. And again, the same old reason, when the Indians tried to steal their guns, it actually brought them to blows. He and his men had met a group of the Blackfoot, and at first they made a kind of uneasy friendship, and Lewis presented some little medals to some of the Blackfoot Indians. When it was time to sleep, Lewis set a guard and gave the guard strict instruction to stay awake and keep watch. But one of the guards fell asleep, and an Indian seized the opportunity to snatch one of the guns and try and run away with it. Lewis woke up in the disturbance, awoke his men, and one of the men chased after the Indian and stabbed him with a gun to get it back. When the Indians then tried to steal their horses, Lewis finally, reluctantly, but took aim and shot one of the Indians in the stomach. The Indian shot back with another stolen gun, and Lewis says, "He overshot me. Being bareheaded, I felt the wind of his bullet very directly. These are people for whom guns are still less familiar, of course. Well, a couple of very, very anxious days followed. This is one of the dramatic highlights of Lewis's journal, where he wonders whether an entire expedition of the Blackfeet aren't going to chase them and run them down. But in the event, they managed to get away with it by hard riding. A few weeks later, Lewis was accidentally shot by one of his own men, Pierre Crouzat. They were out hunting elk. And he took a bullet through the thigh, which narrowly missed shattering the bone. And at first, they thought that this was itself evidence of another Indian attack, as it was just 10 or 12 days after the Blackfoot incident. But no Indians were found in the neighbourhood, and Lewis realised that what had happened was that Crouzat himself had shot. Crouzat said he'd shot an elk in the willow thickets, but that's where Lewis had been. Obviously, hunting accidents right up to the present have remained commonplace. And so Lewis was a convalescent for the rest of the way home, suffering severe pain and discomfort from a bullet lodged in his thigh. But despite all their great adventures, they did in fact arrive back in St. Louis in the fall of the year 1806, finding that the local people were astonished to see them. They'd been given up as dead long ago. Jefferson was almost alone in thinking, well, they might still be alive, and sure enough, they were. An army officer in St. Louis told them, we'd long been given up by the people of the United States generally, and almost entirely forgotten. The President of the United States alone yet had hopes of us. Their journal entries amounted to 900,000 words, a lot of information. They'd been away for 28 months, and they'd travelled 8,000 miles. They were tormented all the way by mosquitoes, often poorly fed, but apart from the death of one man who died from an inoperable disease, Sergeant Floyd, in the early weeks, they'd had no casualties, a really incredible achievement when you think that normally army expeditions suffered constant attrition from epidemics. Back in Washington, D.C., both of them were awarded land grants, given 1,600 acres of land each by a grateful Congress in recognition of their services to the nation. The ordinary men who'd gone with them, the recruits, were given 320 acres each, plus double pay for 28 months' work, which would then be a very tidy sum indeed. Clark stopped off at his home in Louisville. Lewis went on to see Jefferson directly, taking with him a Mandan chief who'd come eastwards to meet the Great White Chief, which is the way they referred to the president. The later lives of Lewis and Clark mark a dramatic contrast. Clark became the commander of the Louisiana militia and later on superintendent of Indian affairs at St. Louis. He did everything he could to help his old friends from the expedition, particularly Sacagawea, whose help had been so crucial in their meeting with the Shoshones. And he created America's first museum of Native American artifacts, in which he'd taken a great deal of interest. And he lived on right through to the year 1838. By contrast, Lewis, always morose and inclined to depression, became an incurable alcoholic and died within 3 years of the end of the expedition. He was briefly governor of the Louisiana Territory, but he was totally unsuited to politics and almost at once began feuding with the people whose cooperation he needed. Travelling back east to unravel some of his financial problems, he died violently in Tennessee, almost certainly by suicide. Though the incident remains a little bit mysterious, Clark at first believed, yes, it really had been a suicide, but then he himself began to doubt it because he thought some of the circumstances sounded wrong. Well, the influence of Lewis and Clark on subsequent American developments is very easy to substantiate. Other explorers also went out across the Great Plains and into the Rocky Mountains. Zebulon Pike, for example, explored the southern Great Plains before Lewis and Clark had come back. And his crossing of the Great Plains led him to conclude, as Lewis and Clark had, that most of that area, the area we now call the Great Plains, would never be inhabited. Between then and the 1860s, this area would appear on maps as the Great American Desert. That sounds a puzzling thing. They didn't mean desert in the way that we do, like the Kalahari or the Sahara Desert, of sort of sand and scrub. But what they meant by it was land which is deserted, because nobody lives there, apart from a handful of these nomadic Indian bands. The reason they thought it would never be populated was because there were no trees there. And because there were no trees, there was no building material, and there was no fuel. Two of the three things, along with food, that you've got to have to make human habitation possible. So the expectation was, although the United States owns this vast area, and although it might be useful as routeways across to the West Coast, it's never going to be habitable by people. And that remained true, really, until the end of the 1860s, when the building of the Transcontinental Railroad meant that the things which were missing locally, like fuel and building materials, could be brought in. And at that point, starting in about 1868 or 9, the rapid development of the Great Plains as a wheat-growing area could flourish. But for the first 50 or 60 years after Lewis and Clark, it didn't. Later on in this course, I'm going to talk about another adventurer who in some ways was cut in the same mould as Lewis and Clark, John Wesley Powell. He was the man who first explored the Grand Canyon by going down it by boat, an adventure of comparable daring.